This is a matter of principle among men who apparently hold their principles dear. It's not as if women don't set foot in the club. They are allowed as guests. But by a margin of just one percentage point, the closest vote yet, women like attorney Mary Milano are prevented from bringing their own guests to this impressive club.
One is continually looking for places where one can feel very comfortable in taking a client or a prospective client and making certain that everything is going to go correctly, that everyone will feel very comfortably, that you will be recognized as being an important person.
It's not that club management wants it this way. Spokesman Tom Wetzel says the president and board members lobbied to let women in, to do the right thing, he says, and also to appease corporate clients who have refused to join the club because of its sexist policy.
Women can constitute a significant segment of the business community in Chicago, and it doesn't make good business sense to ignore that segment.
What may have sunk the vote for women was a letter sent to members by a committee of 54 warning that women happy to join now might later complain about the plan to build them separate facilities. That issue, says Mary Milano, might at least hit close to the real problem for male separatists.
The only argument that I think I've heard raised is the swimming pool issue.
What is that?
Apparently, and I have no personal knowledge of this, there are a number of men who traditionally have used swimming pools in private clubs without swimming suits. And I've actually heard quite a few say, how could we work the swimming pool out?
This is not the last we'll hear of this issue. As one proponent of female members warns, we're all fighters, we don't give up easily. That quote is from a man on the inside. But from the outside, women are perhaps a bit more practical. The Union League Club, as a key player in many civic and political developments in Chicago, may be one of the most important social clubs barring women, but it is far from the only one. Mary Milano says that of perhaps a dozen exclusive country clubs in the area, she doesn't know of any that allow women as full-fledged members. So as the networking moves to the golf courses for the summer, even women who might have belonged to the downtown Union League Club would still be left out in the cold. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. In 1100 AD, the Catholic Church was the entertainment center for most European communities. Many plays written then were performed in the church, and the play of the Antichrist was among the most popular. Today, this work is the subject of a doctoral thesis by Chicagoan Amy Carr, who spent much of the past 10 years researching its history and meaning. Carr didn't expect to stage the story until she happened to meet the head of Chicago's American Medieval Players. A year later, the curtain went up on Apocalypse Then, the 12th century music drama, Play of the Antichrist.
I feel like I've given birth to something, although I had a lot of midwives here. We each like to take as much credit as possible, I'm supposed. When I started working on this play, it was a Latin words that I had to work very hard to understand in a Latin class. And it was, you know, books in a library, some kind of imagination in my head. I never in a million years dreamed I would ever see it on the stage.
Carr took the first step toward modernizing this story of Christ and Antichrist struggling for control of the 12th century world. Her translation and the work of other scholars make the current version palatable for today's American audience. The main obstacle to performing it, though, was finding the music, which was mentioned in the text but not preserved. A German musicologist did discover one piece, and another seems to fit the story, though there's no conclusive evidence it was originally sung with this text. The rest of the music was carefully constructed from other period sources. Music director Andy Schultz began with Carmina Burana, a rich source of many kinds of music from the same period and southern German location as the play of Antichrist.
The German way of writing music at this time was to use symbols indicating the melody was going up, the melody was going down. And what musicologists started to do after the Second World War was to say, okay, what are some of the texts in this Carmina Burana, and is there music that we can decipher preserved in any other libraries, for example, in France or in England? And they were able then to reconstruct a lot of the music in the Carmina Burana by comparing it to sources as far afield as Barcelona and London and saying, yes, this is the same text and we can tell the melody goes up and the melody goes up and blah, blah, blah. And more or less the same thing happened in our play, and we included then a melody from France, from Compiègne, to use as the music for our procession.
The music draws in the audience, giving the flavor of the era and of the story. The technique works especially well with the piece called Laudes Regiae, or Hail to the King. Originally the coronation music for a 12th century king of Sicily, Amy Carr explains how it's now used to signal the coronation of the play's Christ.
At that point, the whole Christian world is united, and in an act which is very much like what the Christian kings did. The Roman emperor in the play says he refuses to rule in a world where Christ is the true King of Kings. And so he gives up his crown, and in doing that, we put in the music that is traditionally sung at the coronation of the emperors, which begins with the Christus Vincit, Christ conquers, Christ reigns, Christ is the emperor. The play, in some ways, embodies, it's a great wish fulfillment for the 12th century. They wanted desperately to see the world unified under Christianity in a reign of peace. They looked toward the emperors and the Crusades to achieve that. And I'm afraid they only managed to achieve it actually in a drama like this.
Also helping bridge the gap between the 12th and 20th centuries are the company's staging tricks. For much of the play, the Antichrist, cloaked in a monk's costume, conceals his true identity from the players by holding a mask of a cherub over his face. The audience, however, does not miss the horns protruding from his forehead and is not fooled when the Antichrist takes control of the world. Ultimately, what makes this ancient work come alive today is more than the staging, music, or careful translation. Amy Carr says it's the subject itself, more relevant today than we might think.
If we take this material at its literal level, that is to say, a retelling of the Christian version of the end of the world, that is material that is still with us, very much part of our culture. The idea of Antichrist comes up all the time. Preachers still preach about it, and people still talk about it. And I think what this tends to make us do, I think, is to become aware of some of these symbols in our own culture, very much obsessed with how the world is going to end. And I think to the extent that we bring back this older material, the traditional material, we can think a little bit about what that tradition has meant to us as a culture.
At the same time, Carr says, we realize we have something in common with those who lived in the 12th century. We may now make different music and enjoy different theater, but our goals and concerns for the world are very much the same. Apocalypse Then, the play of Antichrist, has closed its initial run. The American Medieval Players are now considering requests to tour, an endeavor the producer says could mean another 2 years' work. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. It's not just one joke, it's 840 jokes. That's how many times composer Satie dictated that this piece be played. Actually, the organizer of this performance, Chicago composer Raymond Wilding White, points out we don't know whether Satie meant to be taken seriously.
We know that he had a very low respect for the crass audiences that went to halls, so he may have been putting it to the audience with this thing. You know, the idea is brilliant. The execution is dubious.
It's not easy to listen to 7 hours' worth of this 30-second melody. It would be even harder to play it all. That's why Wilding White is one of 45 pianists who took a 10-minute turn on the bench.
I'm somehow reminded of Mark Twain's, what was it, Captain Stormfield's trip to heaven, where this man goes to heaven and he gets his wings and his harp and his hymn book and he sits down on a cloud and he starts singing the only tune he knows, which is a hymn tune. After he's done it a dozen times, another guy sitting on another cloud says, young man, do you know another tune? And he says, no, I don't. And he says, well, young man, eternity is a very long time.
10 minutes seemed like an eternity for some of the day's performers. James McDonald opened the show.
I was worried about keeping track of how many times I had done it, but that came easily. But in the transfer from me to the next pianist, I made a mistake. As I was sliding over on the piano bench, I played a major third, which in this piece really sticks out. Well, it's actually 13 quarter note pulses. It's not divided into measures per se.
Is it my imagination, or is even that 30 seconds repetitious in itself?
Yes, absolutely. And the right hand is playing tritones, nothing but tritones, which was the evil interval in the Middle Ages and Renaissance music. And then he has a counterpoint in the left hand. So what he does is you play 6.5 pulses with these tritones in the right hand, then you play another 6.5 pulses. The left hand is the same, but the right hand is inverted.
The complexities and subtleties of this piece seem to be lost on the audience, which dwindled with each passing melody. The first spectator left after just 12 minutes. After 15, a worker in an adjoining office pulled his door closed. Most of those making a quick exit shook their heads as they left.
I like Beethoven, Chopin, all those. Not a few notes, repeating. It's too boring.
I thought maybe it would sound a little bit better melody, but it's not too bad, I guess. Maybe it grows on you after a while.
Well, I work here, and I'm going to have to listen to this for 840 times.
Can you close your office door?
Yeah, but it still seeps through, so.
This?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, there is nothing.
The performers accepted this reaction. Pianist Frank Abinandi even expected it.
The intention of the piece is to ruffle some feathers, which is his influence around Dada and Surrealism, which came a little bit later after Satie. So if people walk out, well, that's part of what avant-garde music is supposed to do.
There were some true Satie fans in the audience, though.
Oh, I think it's a lovely melody, and it's very soft, and it's engaging, and you can think with it.
It's actually very nice. It's very tranquil. It's kind of like a Zen piece, you know, just repeats over and over again and puts you into a state of higher consciousness.
The thought of an audience offering such mixed reviews might have given Satie a chuckle. It's a shame he never witnessed his own prank in action. Though it was written in 1894, the first known performance of Vexations was in New York in 1963, 38 years after the composer's death. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
No, that's not very good.
I can't make any words, though.
No, I can't do Donald Duck. It's one of my weaknesses.
That's the best I can do. I guess we're just unartistic.
Can you do a Donald Duck?
Quack, quack.
Can you say anything like Donald Duck?
Squawk.
I can't do it.
Get a chance. Either of you can do one?
No, I'm not.
Not at all?
I wish.
Like you will try? Okay, let me hear you do your Donald Duck. Say, that's a good one in Donald Duck talk. Can you laugh like Donald Duck?
That's the best I could do.
Say, can you say anything? Can you try and say, that's a good one, yuck, yuck? For thousands of kids around the country, school is not a brick building, but their own kitchen where mother or father is the teacher, principal, and chief disciplinarian. Critics and even some proponents of homeschooling worry that these kids don't get the necessary socialization when they study alone. In Chicago, a group of parents have found a unique way to solve that problem by creating their own classroom without compromising their homeschooling philosophy. Marge Halperin reports.
Are you sleeping? Are you sleeping? Are you sleeping?
Every 2 weeks, these kids are thrilled to do what more conventionally schooled kids take for granted: play in the gym, tote a lunchbox, gossip with friends in the hallway between classes, and have school pictures taken. They do it at a school their parents call Park Days, held at a neighborhood church in suburban Arlington Heights. Sue Mazur, one of several mothers who organized Park Days 3 years ago, says this school provides the best of a conventional school experience.
My kids are in fourth and first, and the baby, and they've never been in a public school situation, so it isn't like they're at home crying, saying, oh, I wish I had a class picture. But I don't know, I still think those are some of the warm things that I remember, you know, from having associations with my friends in school and stuff. And so this just ties it in a little bit. And it gives them a sense of community so that they don't feel weird.
The kids aren't the only ones who, without Park Days, might have felt a bit odd telling friends they're homeschooled. Mazur says Park Days is also reassuring for the parents.
Yes, of course, just being here affirms what we're doing, because look at all these other people doing it. You know, you go home not feeling weird too.
So every other Friday, Park Days school is in session. Academics are, for the most part, still left to the home classroom. Kids here concentrate on group activities, like cooking class, 4-H club meetings, art, music, and printing a school newspaper. New classes are added whenever there's a parent who wants to teach and kids interested in the subject. About 50 students attend Park Days, ranging from infants who watch from propped-up baby seats to high schoolers. All seem delighted to attend. But for some, this twice-a-month taste of classroom life isn't enough. At only 10 years old, Elizabeth Carr remembers the early years in a conventional school, and she wants to go back.
I need to get to know people. I'm a very domineering person, and if I don't learn to be with other people and to get along with other people, then I can have problems later on. That's one of the reasons Park Day is kind of nice.
Elizabeth's mother, Peggy, doesn't agree her daughter would be better off in a conventional school. She thinks Park Days satisfies Elizabeth's need for a peer group.
It's really special for her to be in this kind of situation because it's controlled. I know that the friends that she's with are friends that are going to help her. And we have basic rules here. You know, you don't tell a student, I don't want to be with you or I don't like you.
If Elizabeth continues to argue for a return to full-time school, Peggy says she'll give in reluctantly.
She's an only child, so it's really important to her to have the socialization that she needs, and that's one reason we're here at Park Days. But I have found out that every time she's with many children at one time, Elizabeth tends to pick up on the socialization so much that it's to the exclusion of her studies. And she gets sick. And normally she's not exposed to all those germs, so she doesn't get sick.
For most of these children, though, Park Days does seem to satisfy the need for contact with peers. There's 12-year-old Eric Johnson, who loves the protective environment of Park Days. He remembers being the class nerd in public school.
We had some problems with the other kids, because, I mean, they used to beat me up and stuff. I don't want to go back. It's just sort of scares me or something. I mean, I've been away so long, I don't know it anymore. It would be like starting over.
Sue Mazur says socialization is more than learning to brave the sometimes cruel ways of other children. She says her kids are getting plenty of the lessons that really count in life.
Let's not keep what we think of as socialization too narrow. You know, you don't have to sit with 25 other kids for 5.5 hours. There's lots more to it. You know, my daughter does volunteer work, and that's real important. You know, she has her own relationship with those women and men over at the Red Cross office because she volunteers over there.
That's a lesson that even 7-year-old Katie Otis can learn, and she has a quick answer for critics of her brand of school.
I tell them that homeschooling is probably more educating than regular public school. I don't really worry about how I'm going to turn out.
And at Park Days, children are learning socialization the same way they learn their academic subjects, with the supervision and guidance of their parents.
Thank you for the companionship that we have, for all the excitement that we share when we come here today. We are truly blessed. Bless our food as we eat it also. Amen.
For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
The highlights of Tara's collection are paintings by artists familiar even to many casual art observers, Andrew Wyeth, John Singer Sargent, Winslow Homer, and James McNeil Whistler. They form the core of the Tara Museum's opening exhibit called A Proud Heritage, Two Centuries of American Art. To complement those works, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia is sending some equally famous pieces from its own collection, emphasizing earlier works, such as John Vanderlyn's Cause Celebre, one of the first nudes by an American artist. The Pennsylvania Academy's director, Linda Bantel, says her contribution is in keeping with the Tara Museum's populist bent.
It is a masterpiece kind of show. It's not meant to be comprehensive. It's meant to be beautiful pictures that people love to see. There's going to be several moments of recognition. Oh, I saw that in my history book. I saw that picture in my art history course, and it's going to be that kind of show. It's not going to give you a great insight into art, American art history. It's going to give you a feeling of gratification that you're standing in front of really beautiful pictures or great American icons.
Tara's permanent collection also fits that description, strong in American Impressionists and in post-war moderns. They're all on view in expansive, bright galleries. This museum is striking, with sweeping spiral staircases, arches, and balconies that make it easy to wander through the five-story museum. Daniel Tara says it's hard to stop before visiting each corner.
Wherever you are, you see paintings somewhere else, in another area, or another room, or another floor. See, you stand here, and you'll see people downstairs. So you'll be looking at paintings here, and yet you'll see people looking at paintings downstairs. And if you come in off the fifth floor, you say to yourself, well, I must go down and see what that's all about.
So the wall from the fourth floor here goes straight up through the fifth floor to the fifth floor ceiling, and you can see the fifth floor gallery.
That's right. So you can see, you can also hang large pictures in a room like this. And as you know, the contemporary works are getting bigger and bigger these days.
The gallery itself paints a modern picture with stark white walls, plush gray carpeting, hand-rubbed oak accents, and along the building's street side, floor-to-ceiling windows. All of this hides behind a normal shopping district facade in the heart of Michigan Avenue's upscale Magnificent Mile.
The old-fashioned notion is that you had to build a museum out in the park somewhere. In a park area, except that the world is changing, and I don't think people have the time to enjoy the advantages of going to a park to go see a beautiful exhibition or an interesting exhibition. I think they want to drop in for 45 minutes and take a good hard look and run, get back to work.
The Pennsylvania Academy's Linda Bantel says that helps meet Tara's goal of bringing art to the masses. Just as important as providing familiar work, she says, is the image of a museum that is comfortable, not imposing, as are some of the nation's more traditional galleries.
The architecture becomes a work of art, like the Whitney or the Guggenheim or the Met, which to walk up those steps at the Met is an awesome experience. And to my mind, this location and this kind of taking buildings that basically were office buildings and renovating them will be less intimidating. Psychologically, I think it's an interesting notion. I'm interested to see how it, in fact, works.
This museum is a culmination of Daniel Tara's 50 years as an art collector. He admits he had to be horsewhipped to go to a museum as a child, but Tara learned to love art after he first fell in love with and married an art historian. Together, they began collecting English paintings, then old masters, then impressionist works, and finally, in the 1960s, discovering American art.
We saw a marvelous collection of American art in a two-level apartment in New York. We'd seen it in museums, in 100 different museums, but we had never seen American paintings because there were very few collectors at that time. People weren't paying any attention to American art, and that's how it all started. It started that night.
Tara's first painting, John Singleton Copley's Lady in a Blue Dress, still hangs over his fireplace at home. He has since added The Jolly Flatboatman by George Caleb Bingham, Winslow Homer's Three Boys on the Shore, and more than one-third of Maurice Brazil Prendergast's 150 monotypes. Tara transferred his collection to a small museum in the Chicago suburb of Evanston in 1980, when he realized it otherwise would be disbanded to pay estate taxes after his death. The museum has been so successful that he's putting much of the collection in the larger downtown location, keeping open the Evanston site as a branch museum. Together, the two Terra museums make a logical legacy, for the man who, as President Reagan's ambassador at large for cultural affairs, serves as the nation's chief cheerleader for American art. Terra has helped organize art symposiums and exhibits around the world, including the Three Generations of Wyeth Art exhibit, now in Moscow, and headed for Terra's own museum in December. Bringing American art to as many people as possible is what Terra says his job and his museums are all about.
You know, it makes you feel that in your own little tiny way, you're a part of history. The best chance we have for sustained peace in the world is to have a better understanding among the peoples of the world. And the best way for us to have an understanding of other peoples, for all of us, is to understand each other's cultures better.
The new Terra Museum of American Art opens today with the exhibit A Proud Heritage, Two Centuries of American Art, running through June 21st. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. Post-intro. The Jewish holiday of Passover begins tonight, an 8-day commemoration of the exodus of the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt. The first two nights are celebrated with a ceremonial dinner called the Seder, where every food has a special meaning. In the center of the Seder table is a plate of the Passover bread, matzah. As Marge Halperin reports, the story behind that flat cracker has been brought to life at a Chicago-area grocery store, where school children are the bakers in a model matzah factory.
Let's go. One, two, three.
Timing
four,
is everything
five,
in making matzah.
Six,
since the
seven,
Jews fleeing
eight,
Egypt didn't have time to let their bread rise, modern matzah has no yeast, and the flour water mixture is rushed into the oven before it can start to ferment.
That's right. When we make matzah, it cannot take more than 18 minutes from the time we mix the flour and the water until the matzah is already all baked out of the oven. If it takes more than 18 minutes, we may not use that matzah for Passover.
Rabbi Yosef Shanowitz is the chief baker at this model bakery. He says that while most matzah eaten by American Jews this Passover was made by machines, this lesson is modeled after one of the nation's few handmade matzah bakeries. Shanowitz pulls a white baker's hat over his yarmulke and proceeds to follow the Torah. It tells Jews to recount the Passover story to their children, a story that emphasizes the role of matzah.
Matzah is certainly the symbol of the entire holiday. Those Jews who are observant eat the matzah throughout the entire 8 days of the holiday. And by children seeing how matzah is made, it adds to the significance of the holiday and to the importance and to the meaning of the holiday.
So the rabbi sets his timer for 18 minutes and gives each child a piece of dough and a rolling pin. Minutes later, the children are waving wafers of slightly grimy matzah.
Now it looks like matzah.
With the timer still ticking, Rabbi Shanowitz perforates the dough with a spiked rolling pin. The tiny holes help bake the dough evenly and serve as final assurance that it doesn't rise. The rounds are then baked at 700 degrees for no longer than 3 minutes.
Children, watch the way the matzahs go into the oven.
The rabbi oversees the baking, and the children learn more about Passover from a videotape, which Shanowitz calls the Jewish Sesame Street. It stars not the familiar puppets Bert and Ernie, but their Jewish cousins, Bernie and George.
This program is brought to you by the Hebrew letter Mem, Matzah, and Maror.
Hi, Mrs. Kahn. What's in the bag?
Hi, Bernie. I have special things for Pesach.
I want to see.
After the film, the children take their matzah home, but the rabbi tells them not to eat it during the holiday. Despite the careful timing, this is not an authentic bakery for Passover, or in Hebrew, Pesach.
In a real Pesach bakery, they would change the tablecloths every 18 minutes because the old flour is no good. It's from the previous 18 minutes, and we don't want that to mix in with the new flour, with the new dough. But they would change the rolling pins, and you have to be above bar and bat mitzvah to bake Pesach matzah. How many of you are bar mitzvah already? Ah, not too many, a few, just a few.
Still, this experience has given the children the taste of a real bakery and of the real handmade matzah that might have been eaten by their ancestors as they fled from Egypt so many years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
The Terra Museum of American Art opens today in Chicago. On display is the personal collection of Daniel Terra, President Reagan's U.S. Ambassador at Large for Cultural Affairs. Reporter Marge Halperin visited the gallery, which reflects Terra's populist approach to modern art.
The highlights of Terra's collection are paintings by artists familiar even to many casual art observers: Andrew Wyeth, John Singer Sargent, Winslow Homer, and James McNeil Whistler. They form the core of the Terra Museum's opening exhibit called A Proud Heritage, Two Centuries of American Art. To complement those works, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia is sending some equally famous pieces from its own collection, emphasizing earlier works. The Pennsylvania Academy's director, Linda Bantel, says her contribution is in keeping with the Terra Museum's populist bent.
It is a masterpiece kind of show. It's not meant to be comprehensive. It's meant to have the beautiful pictures that people love to see. There's going to be several moments of recognition. Oh, I saw that in my history book. I saw that picture in my art history course. And it's going to be that kind of show. It's not going to give you a great insight into American art history. It's going to give you a feeling of gratification that you're standing in front of really beautiful pictures or great American icons.
Terra's permanent collection also fits that description, strong in American Impressionists and in post-war moderns. They're all on view in expansive, bright galleries. This museum is striking with sweeping spiral staircases, arches, and balconies that make it easy to wander through the five-story museum. Daniel Terra says it's hard to stop before visiting each corner.
Wherever you are, you see paintings somewhere else, in another area, or another room, or another floor. So you stand here, you'll see people downstairs. So you'll be looking at paintings here, and yet you'll see people looking at paintings downstairs. And if you come in off the fifth floor, you say to yourself, well, I must go down and see what that's all about.
So the wall from the fourth floor here goes straight up through the fifth floor to
that's
the
right.
fifth floor ceiling, and you can
that's
see
right.
the fifth floor gallery.
That's right. So you can see, you can also hang large pictures in a room like this. And as you know, the contemporary works are getting bigger and bigger these days.
The gallery itself paints a modern picture with stark white walls, plush gray carpeting, hand-rubbed oak accents, and along the building's street side, floor-to-ceiling windows. All of this hides behind a normal shopping district facade in the heart of Michigan Avenue's upscale Magnificent Mile.
The old-fashioned notion is that you had to build a museum out in the park somewhere. In a park area, except that the world is changing, and I don't think people have the time to enjoy the advantages of going to a park to go see a beautiful exhibition or an interesting exhibition. I think they want to drop in for 45 minutes and take a good hard look and run and get back to work.
The Pennsylvania Academy's Linda Bantel says that helps meet Terra's goal of bringing art to the masses. Just as important as providing familiar work, she says, is the image of a museum that is comfortable, not imposing, as are some of the nation's more traditional galleries.
The architecture becomes a work of art, like the Whitney or the Guggenheim or the Met, which to walk up those steps at the Met is an awesome experience. And to my mind, this location and this kind of taking buildings that basically were office buildings and renovating them will be less intimidating. Psychologically, I think it's an interesting notion. I'm interested to see how it, in fact, works.
This museum is a culmination of Daniel Terra's 50 years as an art collector. He admits he had to be horsewhipped to go to a museum as a child, but Terra learned to love art after he first fell in love with and married an art historian. Together, they began collecting English paintings, then old masters, then impressionist works, and finally, in the 1960s, discovering American art.
We saw a marvelous collection of American art in a two-level apartment in New York. We'd seen it in museums, in 100 different museums, but we had never seen American paintings because there were very few collectors at that time. People weren't paying any attention to American art. And that's how it all started. It started that night.
Tara's first painting, John Singleton Copley's Lady in a Blue Dress, still hangs over his fireplace at home. He has since added The Jolly Flatboatman by George Caleb Bingham, Winslow Homer's Three Boys on the Shore, and more than one-third of Maurice Brazil Prendergast's 150 monotypes. Tara transferred his collection to a small museum in the Chicago suburb of Evanston in 1980, when he realized it otherwise would be disbanded to pay estate taxes after his death. The museum has been so successful that he's putting much of the collection in the larger downtown location, keeping open the Evanston site as a branch museum. Together, the two Tara museums make a logical legacy, for the man who, as President Reagan's ambassador at large for cultural affairs, serves as the nation's chief cheerleader for American art. Tara has helped organize art symposiums and exhibits around the world, including the Three Generations of Wyeth Art exhibit, now in Moscow, and headed for Tara's own museum in December. Bringing American art to as many people as possible is what Tara says his job and his museums are all about.
You know, it makes you feel that in your own little tiny way, you're a part of history. The best chance we have for sustained peace in the world is to have a better understanding among the peoples of the world. And the best way for us to have an understanding of other peoples, for all of us, is to understand each other's cultures better.
The new Tara Museum of American Art opens today with the exhibit A Proud Heritage, Two Centuries of American Art, running through June 21st. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago.
This is NPR's Performance Today for April 28th. I'm Catherine Lumens.
I think growing old is something that everybody has to face, so just have to do it with your eyes open and see how it feels at the time.
Choreographer Ruth Page is being honored today by Chicago, where she's made her home and promoted the art of dance. The city is naming a street after her, and tonight the Ruthies Dance Awards named for her will be announced. We'll talk with Ruth Page about some of her early recollections, and Marge Halperin reports on the influence Ruth Page has had on dance, especially in Chicago. Also this half hour, music from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, and Glenn Gould plays a bronze piano piece, eventually called a rhapsody, all on Performance Today. This evening, the city of Chicago will be changing the name of one of its streets. A section of West Delaware will become Ruth Page Place. Ruth Page, who recently celebrated her 88th birthday, has been active in the Chicago ballet community since she moved to the Windy City in 1919. In 1928, she gave a performance at the coronation of Japan's Emperor Hirohito, and she was the only female American dancer to join Serge Diaghilev's famed Ballet Russe. Page began her professional dancing career in high school in Indianapolis. In 1918, she toured with Anna Pavlova and still remembers when she went with her mother to audition for the great ballerina.
She was the most thrilling dancer that ever lived, I guess. And I was just a young, very young girl when I first came across her. My mother took me to see her in Indianapolis. And so I danced for her. I don't know how I ever had the nerve to, because I hadn't even had any lessons. But she asked me if I would join her company, and I said, you bet I will. And so I did, and I was with her for a whole year. And it was a very spectacular year. We went all around South America for a whole year. I spent in South America with her. My mother went with me. And I don't know if I know, really learned anything about Pavlova's private life. I didn't pay attention. I was only really interested in her dancing, which was so inspirational. It really was.
Over the years, Ruth Page developed her own distinctive performance style. Sheila Malkind, Page's assistant, attributes the dancer's uniqueness to her upbringing.
Her father used to recite poetry at the dinner table, and her family, her father in particular, was friendly with James Whitcomb Riley and some other Indiana Hoosier poets. So she did something which was rather unusual. She did a lot of ballets in which she recited poetry at the same time. And one of her ballets, called Billy Sunday, in which Danila Vestard had that very idea. There was a lot of talk as well interspersed with dance.
Ruth Page has had her share of controversy in her career. In 1938, she choreographed Frankie and Johnny with Bentley Stone. The New York Times characterized the ballet as coarse, raucous, and witty. The piece was temporarily banned in Boston, and it was performed by the Ballet Russe in Paris in 1947. Page has spent a lifetime developing dances for illustrious companies, the Metropolitan Opera Ballet, the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, the London Festival Ballet, and the Dance Theater of Harlem all have commissioned her choreography. In her own works and in her dancing, Page finds concentration essential.
You have to think about what you're going to dance, and then try to combine the acting with the dancing so that it makes physical sense. That's not easy to do.
Ruth Page has received many citations, including honorary doctorates and a Peabody Award for her televised production of The Merry Widow on PBS. In Chicago, where she's made her home, Page has founded her own school and trained young dancers to perform. Marge Halperin went to a ballet class to talk with Page's colleagues and students.
One. And up. And up. The feet.
Some 350 students follow in Ruth Page's footsteps every year, taking classes at her school of dance. Page only teaches an occasional class herself, but school director Larry Long says her unique, lively interpretations color lessons by all of the faculty. Long says he often hears Page's voice as he teaches his own classes.
I'll give an exercise, one that has certain technical and physical problems. After I've said, you know, you've got to make sure that your placement is correct and that you're moving from the center and you're doing all these things, technical things. But then I will say at the end of all that, which is very Ruth Page, and for God's sakes, don't be boring. Nothing is worse than being boring. You know, it's better to be a little bit outré and a little bit vulgar and a little bit bizarre rather than just be, you know, really proficient and very pure and boring, boring.
To make sure her school is never boring, Paige lends her own spark to classes by showing up most days as a student. She takes the bar for warm-up exercises to keep in shape, though her failing health no longer allows for the more strenuous performances. Larry Long says that when Paige is in the room, everyone dances that extra mile. He strives to impress, too, even after working with Paige for 30 years.
Yes, I always make a more special effort. I always try to make a special effort, but somehow when Ruth is around, you always try to do a bit more. I don't want to be boring when, I don't want to give a boring class when Ruth's around. And I surely don't want to give a boring class when Ruth's in it.
It's not that Paige demands an extra effort from teachers or students. Her mere presence seems to inspire each dancer to do his or her best.
It's kind of exciting. I don't know, because she's like really old and she'll come and she'll take bar and it's just neat that she can still come and walk around when she's that old.
I should be so lucky to be doing anything that approaches what she's doing at her age. It amazes me.
Ruth just has to walk in and into the building and everyone is aware that she's here. The little children, they all come up to her and they say, "Hello, Miss Page," and they give her a kiss and she, you know, leans over and gives them a kiss. They love her.
Teacher Warren Conover says it's easy to love Ruth Page. Students never forget she's a star, but she never seems to remember. And each student has a story to show how Page's easygoing jokes make her seem like just another dancer.
She said something funny to Warren one time. He demonstrated an exercise of some sort, and she looked, you know, sort of perplexed or something, and he said, can you see me? She said, "Oh, yes, I can see you, dear. You look beautiful." You know, something like that.
Oh, I remember one day coming up the stairs behind her and asking her how she was, and she said, "Well, I'm here."
She said, if I can make it to the school, I can make it up the stairs. If I can make it up the stairs, then I can make it through class.
The students appreciate Paige for more than her sense of humor. They understand that her commitment to Chicago dance is slowly but surely upgrading their second city status and increasing their job opportunities. Paige's production of the Nutcracker Suite each December is Chicago's largest ballet of the year, employing more dancers than any other show and paying union scale. Paige also supports and promotes local dance companies. Claire Bataille dances with Chicago's Hubbard Street Dance Company.
She's been a fan of ours from the very beginning when we were very small and is always present at our performances and has hosted some real nice receptions for us. It's great. It's nice to know that she's there for every company in Chicago.
Paige also attracts established ballet stars to Chicago. Mikhail Baryshnikov has called her school one of the top four in the country. He takes a class there whenever the American Ballet Theater is in town. That, too, gives Paige's students inspiration. Larry Long says it's all part of her commitment to Chicago dance, a commitment he says hasn't wavered since Paige first came here in 1919.
The number of artists that she has promoted from Chicago who've gone on to international careers has been incredible. No matter what we think, Chicago is still not the hub of American dance. New York City still is. However, I think more and more people are beginning to realize that Chicago is one of the best places to start. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Ruth has just been here. She's never given up on Chicago.
And Chicago hasn't given up on Ruth Paige. Now she truly is a part of the city, as officials hang the Ruth Paige Place sign in the neighborhood Paige adopted as her home nearly 70 years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
This evening, the Chicago Dance Coalition will be presenting its dance awards called Ruthies. And this afternoon, in a special ceremony, Ruth Paige will be recognized once again when the city to which she's devoted so much of her talent officially names a section of West Delaware Street Ruth Paige Place. In a moment, Glenn Gould plays Brahms.
Voodoo is more than a primitive superstition. It's the focus for creative and beautiful art. That's the premise of Spirit and Image, an unusual exhibit this month at Chicago's School of the Art Institute. The school's gallery gives such a vivid picture of the Haitian religious experience that as visitors gaze at altars strewn with glittering artifacts, they can almost hear the drum beats and chants of a real voodoo ritual. Marge Halperin takes us on a tour. In the villages of Haiti, natives turn to the gods for help with everyday problems. They beat cowhide drums, unfurl shimmering sequin flags, and shake beaded rattles to gather first the mortals, then the gods, to a ceremony meant to heal all earthly ills.
Whether it's the twins, and implied in that of the infant children is fertility, whether it's love through the Urzules coming down, whether it's the idea of getting more power, and then Ogun comes down, and you can kind of draw off of his power. Or whether it's the idea of dealing with the ancestors through death and the concept of regeneration with the Baron Samedi or the Geddes. All of those ranges of those concerns then become tangible when those gods come down.
Anthropologist Marilyn Holberg, co-curator of the Spirit and Image exhibit, says the gods come down to a ceremonial altar, like the one that serves as a focal point in this gallery. At the base are plates of food and lacy designs sprinkled on the floor with cornmeal. These are a sort of coat of arms representing specific gods the natives want to meet and are used as an engraved invitation. On the altar itself, decorated with beads and sequins, or left clear to show dolls crammed inside, are liquor bottles of all shapes and sizes.
Some of them have removable tops. They'll screw off and everything. And then the favored liquid of that particular god that is symbolized in the color sequins on the outside, or the pattern. You'll see one there, Dambala. The snake, the rainbow serpent god that came from the fawn of West Africa, and the favorite drink of Dambala would go in there. And since he's a very cool type of spirit, it would be something that would not be strong drink. It would probably be something perhaps like a fruit drink or something that would be not highly volatile as far as hot rum or something like that.
Once the gods arrive, Holberg says, they slip inside an available body, possessing one of the natives to join the ceremony. But Haitians don't need that elaborate ritual to contact the gods. They can do it with the help of a voodoo doll. Here at Chicago's School of the Art Institute, there's a table full of those dolls, but not one wears the cruel voodoo pins we see in the movies. Holberg says the dolls are not evil icons, but generic figures meant to show the gods the good life the makers seek. The Haitians will pray for favors and leave the dolls as a reminder, or even wrap the dolls in a letter that spells out their specific request.
What you want to do is get to where the spiritual action is and get your own request in. Usually it's something positive that you want to happen for yourself. And so you might go out then with one of these dolls and use it as a messenger, in essence.
And what are they made out of?
Well, they're just, they're stuffed with cotton and maybe sometimes old cloth. They, as you see here, some of the colors, red, black. They tend to be either male or female, and that's made quite clear usually.
They're anatomically correct.
Anatomically correct. But it doesn't matter how schematic they are. What they have to do is deliver their messages. That's the most crucial thing.
These dolls are strictly business. Their crude shapes and unadorned bodies pale next to the glittering paquettes or sachets used to call the gods to a sick bed. They are filled with healing leaves and decorated with satin ribbons, beads, sequins, and feathers. Holberg says that's more in keeping with the artistic theme of a voodoo ritual.
All of this material is available in the main market in Port-au-Prince. So there still is a sort of French legacy of fancy things, you know? Perfumes are very important to the gods, goddesses in particular. If you know you're going to a ceremony to honor a goddess of love, you usually make a stop in the perfume shop, you know? So I've actually had the fun experience of trying to deliberate whether, you know, Cacherel, Anais would be more for, you know, more appropriate than other kinds of perfumes, you know. So as my daughter, once we were trying to pick out perfumes, and she said, Mom, if you were a goddess, how would you like a mere mortal interfering with your, you know, sacrifice, you know, get that expensive one. So we did relent and do that. And then afterwards she said, you know, I've never been shopping for a goddess before.
Throughout this explanation, students from this prestigious school look over Holberg's shoulder. She knows many question this exhibit, wondering if it really belongs in an art school. Holberg has no such doubts.
Some might say, well, can we really talk about real art and sequins in the same breath, you know? But I say, yes, you certainly can. And we want them to see that all that glitters is sequin flags, yes.
Anthropologist Holberg collaborated with artist Park Chambers to set up this voodoo exhibit. It's Chambers who first thought these artifacts belonged in a gallery. He even painted the walls a flat black to offset the shimmering voodoo flags. They seem to float along the surface just as they float through the air when the natives wave them to signal the start of a new ceremony.
When you see these objects in motion, they come alive in a different way. And there's a whole inner dynamics between the objects and the participants, much as we have in performance or theater or dance, and they all become interrelated and act together.
So is their art form?
Yes, it's a total art form from beginning to end, as well as, you know, from object to the actual movement of those objects through space and time.
Like Holberg, Chambers has heard murmurs from disbelievers of this art form, but he's also seen them come around as they're absorbed in the glittery display.
I think they're more startled at seeing objects like this as art rather than expecting the typical association of voodoo, you know, dark images and things like that. And they do function as art, and people read them that way when they approach the gallery and are really delighted to see that there are artifacts from this culture and not just a mumbo-jumbo religious thing going on.
Spirit and Image, a display of voodoo artifacts, is at Chicago's School of the Art Institute Gallery through Saturday and will reopen in an expanded form at the UCLA Cultural History Museum next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago.